the cops would have even more reason to investigate him. And when they did, maybe there'd be a breakthrough in Kelsey's case. She was allowed to feel good about that, right? The anxiety had hit her pretty hard once she'd gotten to the sheriff's office, but she'd gotten through it on her own. She was going to count the whole day as a success, even if it had led to her first, and hopefully last, arrest.
You want to go inside for a coffee?
Surprised, she looked at the building she was parked next to. It was a popular hangout for high schoolers. Janie had never been there. Judging by the number of cars in the parking lot, it was busy. I don't think so.
Mind if I do? I gotta get warmed up. Wait here!
Without another word, he had the door open and was dashing to the entrance of the structure. She turned down the heat that was blasting through the vents and checked the dash clock. 45 minutes before she needed to be at work. She had nothing else to do to pass the time, but she hadn't considered spending it all with Cole Bogart. She didn't know him. Janie kept reminding herself of that. And not too long ago, she hadn't had a great impression of him. But that was before, when all she'd had to go on was hearing about him hacking the school server, before he'd told her about his brother. She stared at the door he'd disappeared through. His brother's death wasn't like Kelsey's disappearance. Nothing was. But it was a tenuous bond that she didn't share with anyone else, not even Olivia. Like she and Cole belonged to the same group in the Shitty Circumstances Club. Membership for life, decided by fate. It's not like she didn't know of other kids in school who'd lost a parent or something. But she'd never talked to them about it. Janie wouldn't have spoken to Cole about his brother, either, if he hadn't come to her house and spilled it all. The scene had been uncomfortable. But it was the first time she'd ever heard anyone else speak about what the loss of a sibling had done to him. The support groups her mom and dad had tried for a while were never an option for Janie. So listening to Cole had been weird, but sort of helpful in a way, to hear from someone else going through something kind of similar. He reappeared, using his shoulder to push out the door, his hands full with two coffees. He saw her watching and held one up, grinning. Reaching over, she unlatched the passenger door, pushed it open.
"I got you a caramel whipped cream espresso."
He handed her a cup.
"Or we can switch if you want. I've got a vanilla cappuccino."
Janie sipped at her drink cautiously. Then her brows rose. "I may as well be drinking hot ice cream."
"Yeah, it's pretty good."
Making himself at home, Cole reached for the lever to move the seat back.
"But if it's ice cream you want, we can finish these and then head over to the Dairy Whip for dessert."
"I'll be there soon enough." She drank again. It was good. The place had a drive-through window. She wouldn't even have to go inside to order here again.
"Sorry you guys didn't get out of the lake house in time."
It wasn't the first time he'd apologized.
"A plane car pulled up beside mine, and the cop inside started hassling me about why I was pulled over. It took me a minute to realize a cruiser had pulled into the drive. Some lookout I was."
"It actually turned out okay."
"How much trouble did you get in with your parents?"
Janie hesitated. She'd fared better than Olivia had, who was currently grounded into infinity. Her friend had even lost cell phone privileges. But she was confident her foster parents would relent. By the time she was done going over the story with them, they'd be convinced she and Janie were modern-day Nancy Drews. "They were all right," she said finally. "I was mostly concerned about my mom." Newman admitted on tape that he'd taken pictures of my sister 7 years ago. "That was hard for her to hear. She hasn't really been the same since Kelsey was kidnapped." And neither, in truth, had her dad. The change had happened so gradually that Janie hadn't even realized how much time he spent away. Maybe he had more responsibility at work. Or perhaps he'd rather be anywhere but home. She couldn't help feeling that it had been more guilt than concern that had led to him showing up at home late Friday night. Janie had already had her mom calmed down by then. She'd insisted Claire take a hot bath, get into bed, and had sat with her until her dad had shown up, unexpectedly.
Who would be the same?
A shadow crossed Cole's expression.
My dad used to be a teetotaler, but now I see a bourbon bottle in his bathroom desk drawer in the den. And sometimes he hits it pretty hard. It's like he's a different person. Then it occurred to me that he was using the bourbon for the same reason I bought weed. That had me backing off it. I don't want to rely on it to get by, you know?
Yeah. The same way Janie didn't want to depend on medication because of her mother's addiction to alcohol and pills. And it was an addiction, even if she could go days without them. Her father seemed blissfully unaware of the problem. Or was it just easier for him to overlook it? He'd lost a daughter, too. If there was one thing their family dynamics proved, it was that everyone managed trauma differently. They all had their own ways of getting by.
My mom stays super busy with work and all these activities and baking. She's always in the kitchen doing something. Like, if she just keeps moving, she can outrun Garrett's death. I think she's afraid if she stops, it's going to steamroll over the top of her.
Janie listened in awkward silence, sipping at the coffee to avoid answering. It felt too personal to hear about the cycle of someone else's grief. She'd been trapped in her own, and in that of her parents since she was 10. But there was a weird sort of comfort in Cole's revelations, too. No one got out of a personal tragedy unscathed. The wounds didn't go away. It was just a matter of how well each person covered them.
I don't know what I'm supposed to be feeling. It sucks to be wrapped in this crappy mourning period, but whenever I catch myself having a good time, I feel guilty, you know? Like, I'm betraying Garrett by enjoying myself. Then I get mad at him for being dead.
He shook his head and took a long gulp of his coffee.
How's that for sick? It's been 2 years. I should be handling things better.
She surprised herself by saying, "Know what I was doing 2 years after my sister was kidnapped?" His head swiveled toward her. "I had just started back to school. For a year and a half afterward, I couldn't leave the house. When I tried, it was like someone stuck a vacuum down my throat and sucked all the air out of my lungs." She felt as though she'd been slowly suffocating. Other times, the tightness in her chest mimicked a heart attack. She'd known that it wasn't real, that it was her mind making her suffer like that. The helplessness of not being able to control her own brain had been the worst part about it. "I was so medicated sometimes I felt like a zombie. And even that was preferable to the anxiety attacks, so you're not doing that bad." He looked at her for a long moment.
"Thanks for telling me that. You probably don't talk about it much."
"I don't talk about anything much." He laughed, and although she hadn't meant it as a joke, she smiled too. "Now I have to go punch in. Doris freaks out if we're not there 15 minutes early. Thanks for the coffee."
"Not a problem."
Hand on the door latch, he paused.
"Is it okay if I text you sometimes?"
The knot in her chest was back. But it felt different this time. "I guess."
"Awesome. See you tomorrow."
The door slammed. A moment later, he was in his car, starting it up. Not wanting to be caught staring, Janie put the vehicle in gear, backed out of the lot, and headed for the Dairy Whip. That had been weird. But a good kind of weird. She waited at the end of the drive for the barely there traffic, and then pulled across the street. Janie still wasn't sure what to think about Cole Bogart. But she was okay with taking some time to find out.
Claire Willard, November 15th, 1:15 p.m. "David, lunch is ready." Claire felt almost normal engrossing herself in daily chores, normal except for the muzzy-headed feeling that was the result of the pills she'd taken in the middle of the night while David lay sleeping. Two, to banish the endless movie reel of the nightmarish events that had been replaying in her mind since Friday. She'd needed the pills to shake the mental image of Kelsey drifting above her, condemnation in her eyes. "I was just trying to protect you," Claire told her daughter silently. "I didn't want the police to see you that way, to think about you like that. You made a mistake, acted out. I covered the best that I could." The mental picture faded, but the regret didn't. It had been weak to fall back on the medication when Janie had powered through her anxiety Friday night while refusing it. Claire could be proud of her daughter while admitting to herself that she didn't have Janie's emotional fortitude, or her brains, for coming up with a plan that would have the police certain to check Kelsey's connection to the photographer, without exposing Claire's part in destroying the pictures. She should be ashamed that her youngest daughter had seen through her lie, but she lacked the will to feel anything but a weary sort of gratitude. "When did this come?" David came into the kitchen, waving a fat envelope. "Why didn't you give it to Janie?" Claire turned from the counter, two plates in her hand. She nearly dropped them when she recognized what he held. "It's from Stanford," he grinned, clearly delighted. "Janie's going to be over the moon." He tested the envelope between two fingers. "Thick. This isn't a polite rejection letter. She's in. Wonder what kind of deal they're offering her." Swallowing hard, Claire forced her feet to continue to the table. She carefully set down the full plates and returned to the counter for the tea she'd prepared for herself. Coffee, of course, for David.
I think it was Friday?
She pretended to be unsure, as if the arrival of the letter hadn't rocked her back on her heels. It had dread pounding through her until that call from the sheriff's office had wiped everything else from her mind. She'd convinced herself that this day wouldn't come, had spun an elaborate fantasy that the prestigious university would have no interest in her daughter's SATs, with the stratospheric science and math scores, her long list of AP classes and perfect grades. That had been a far easier fabrication to believe than the one she had, that seeing the letter wouldn't cement Janie's college decision. The thought of her daughter being halfway across the country less than a year from now had her throat drying out, a familiar panic spreading through her. "I found it in the drawer of the hallway table when I was looking for a different garage door opener." David went to the refrigerator and attached the letter to a magnetic clip where Janie would be certain to see it, since the fridge was the first place she headed to upon arriving home. "I don't know why you would have put it in there." He turned then, and catching sight of her expression, his gaze turned shrewd. "Claire, you weren't trying to hide this from her, were you?"
"Honestly, David, of course not."
She sat down and spread her napkin on her lap. "I don't even recall putting it away. The phone must have rung when I brought in the mail, and I shoved it in there absent-mindedly and forgot about it. Janie didn't come home after school, remember? With everything else that happened that night, it completely slipped my mind." He took a seat, reaching for his coffee. "Well, I know you haven't wanted to think about her choosing Stanford over OSU, but we have to consider what's best for her future. It's probably time to make an appointment with that counselor, Rimble. She can help us evaluate the best college offers as they come in. Not that Janie will need to consider finances first and foremost." He set down his cup and picked up the ham sandwich she'd fixed. "We have plenty in her college account to afford wherever she chooses, even if the package is stingy."
"Of course they did."
Claire nibbled at the edge of her sandwich. For the first time, she almost resented the lifestyle David's success afforded them. Although Janie's academic resume alone would be strong enough for her to snare the interest of most universities, her appetite had fled. Instead of eating, she watched David enjoy the meal she'd fixed. In that age-old trick of Mother Nature, he was growing more handsome with the passing years. His hair was flecked with silver, where many men his age were balding or totally gray. He'd shocked her by coming home Friday night after the phone conversation they'd had. He'd attended his meeting first, of course, but he'd been here before she'd gone to sleep. She'd feigned exhaustion, letting Janie be the one to lead him from the room and apprise him of the events of the evening. Claire hadn't been able to relive them again. It had been traumatic enough being in that cramped space with Janie and the deputies, listening to the recording of that horrid man admit that he'd taken those revealing pictures of Kelsey? What else had he done? Had Kelsey gone there alone? Those were the questions her mind had seized on to worry about like a dog with a bone. Surely not. Surely she'd had the sense to take someone else along, like Janie had. But Kelsey had been unpredictable her last few weeks at home. As great as Claire's need was to reconstruct every moment of their daughter's last days in West Bend, she wasn't certain she had the fortitude to face what the interview with Newman might reveal. With effort, she searched for a topic to take her mind off her daughter. "How's work? I haven't seen Kurt and Linda for ages." "Fine. Same old, same old." He reached for the newspaper sitting on the table in front of him. "Kurt will never slow down." And neither, it seemed, would David. She managed to take a bite of the sandwich, chewed slowly. He'd headed back to Columbus on Saturday, but not until late afternoon, and he'd surprised her by coming straight home afterward. He must have been more worried than he let on about Janie's run-in with the sheriff's office, although they'd barely discussed it. Claire had the feeling that between her daughter and husband, she was being wrapped in gossamer, as though she might shatter with a careless word. She wished with all her heart that she could assure them that their caution was unnecessary. "I thought we'd have heard something from the sheriff's office by now." Like a tongue touching a sore tooth, her mind circled back to the same thoughts. Sergeant Rossi promised he would keep us apprised.
"Wouldn't be the first time the police failed to keep that promise."
The bitterness in David's tone had her glancing at him. He was scowling at the sports page.
"How many times during the course of Kelsey's investigation did..."
His words were interrupted by the peal of the doorbell. They both started to rise. "Stay. Finish eating." Claire placed her napkin on the table and rose to hurry to the front door. She checked the peephole. An instant bout of nausea rose in her stomach as she saw the BCI agent and a strange woman standing on her porch. She pulled the door open.
"Agent Foster, ma'am."
"This is Agent Medford."
There was a lazy scatter of snowflakes in the air. They adorned the agent's hair, their coats in artistic randomness.
"Is your husband home, Mrs. Willard? We have something to discuss with you both."
Something grim, judging from their expressions. Claire clutched the door jamb for support, her knees feeling watery. "Yes," she said faintly. "Of course." She and David had just been talking about Sergeant Rossi's promise to inform the BCI agents of the developments with Newman, and then they'd appeared, as if their words had summoned them. She stepped aside to allow them to enter. While they stomped the fresh powder off their boots, she turned to fetch David, found him already approaching.
"Agents Foster and Medford have something they want to share with us."
"We were just saying that we haven't been updated about Friday's events at the lake house."
There was a glitter of animosity in David's eyes that took Claire aback. She'd been as distressed as he was about the lack of communication, but the agent's arrival changed things. Turning back toward them, she waved them into the formal living room.
"Please, come in and sit."
Claire hadn't seen the stunning blonde woman with Foster before. She didn't look much like police. But then Claire didn't remember ever meeting a woman in law enforcement, with the exception of the security guard at the bank.
"Can I get you anything? A cup of coffee?"
"No, thank you."
She sat down on the edge of the sofa, barely aware when David sat next to her.
"We've been working closely with the sheriff's office for the last 36 hours, Mark began.
"Have you interviewed Newman?"
David asked the question on the tip of Claire's tongue.
"What does he know about Kelsey?"
"We have spoken to him, yes,"
the woman answered this time.
"We'll be talking to him again very soon. While he admits to taking photographs of your daughter shortly before she was kidnapped, he denies any other knowledge of her."
"When?"
David demanded.
"When does he say he took the pictures?"
"He claimed it was 2 or 3 weeks before she disappeared."
2 or 3 weeks. Claire's mind flashed back to the recording Janie had played for the deputies. There had been discussion of payment for the photos.
Newman had indicated any money could be gotten only through a modeling job once he sent the pictures onward. But other than school, Kelsey hadn't been gone for more than a few hours at a time, so she certainly hadn't modeled. Where had the money in the envelope with the photos come from?
"He's lying." David's voice was impatient. "He probably knows far more than he's telling. Where are these pictures? Maybe there will be something in them to prove he's holding back."
"We served a warrant on his home and car and seized his cameras and computer equipment. They've been delivered to the state lab, where cyber scientists will go over them as early as tomorrow." Mark's gaze was intent. "We'll have those answers for you shortly. Unfortunately, there's a more compelling matter we have to discuss with you. While searching the lake house location for evidence, a body was found." The room tilted, righted itself, still slightly askew.
"What?"
Claire reached out to grab her husband's hand.
"David, what are they saying?"
"I'm so sorry to bring you this news." And the agent did look regretful, Claire thought dimly. So did the other agent, so pretty in spite of the somberness of her expression. "It's a young girl, age 14 to 19. She's dressed in a ballet outfit, posed. More testing is required before we can say how long she's been down there, although we know she was moved after her death. She didn't die at the lake house."
"Ballet clothes," David said dully. "The TMK left his victims like that."
"I'm sorry." Mark glanced down, swallowed hard, and then lifted his head to look at them again. "Yes, the victim matches the manner in which the other TMK victims were found, with the exception of the location." Claire was spiraling away, like a grain of sand whirling in a drain's vortex. She could feel herself fading, the voices growing distant.
"That poor girl. Her parents will be so devastated."
Having that last thread of hope snapped had to be the worst sort of nightmare.
"Jesus Christ, Claire!"
David's voice broke as he brought his free hand to his eyes. "DNA tests will be run tomorrow." The female agent, Medford, was talking. "But we have a preliminary match on the dental records. We're fairly certain the victim is your daughter, Kelsey." A loud sob broke from David, and his shoulders shook. Claire slipped her arm around him.
"No, that's not right," she told him certainly. Then she turned to the agents. "It's not, Kelsey."
"I know this is unbearably hard," Mark began.
"No. You know what's hard, Agent Foster?"
She could hear her voice growing strident, was helpless to temper it.
"What's hard is receiving 8 calls from police in different parts of the state telling us they had human remains, that's what they called them, unidentified human remains that they were going to try to match to Kelsey's DNA samples. 8 times in 5 years, because we haven't had a call in a while."
Because everyone had forgotten all about the Willards, wrapped up in their cocoon of misery awaiting their daughter's return.
"And every time, 8 times, they were wrong. Like you're wrong, now."
She gently extricated herself from her husband, stood.
"I want to be taken to her."
Mark looked pained as he rose. "Mrs. Willard, please. The DNA tests tomorrow will be all that's necessary. You don't have to put yourself through this."
"Yes, I do." The words quaked. "Because you're wrong, and I'm going to prove it to you. That girl isn't Kelsey. She's not my daughter. My daughter is alive."
David Willard, November 15th, 3:06 p.m. David sat in the back seat of the sedan next to his wife. No one in the vehicle said a word. What was left to say? He'd done his best to talk Claire out of this, but there was no reasoning with her. He was used to dealing with his wife on the verge of collapse, used to managing her hysterics. But she wasn't hysterical now. She was eerily calm. fixed in her certainty, despite the proof of the dental records the agents had mentioned. That calm was more unsettling than hysterics would have been. There had been phone calls to make, arrangements to set in place. The morgue was in the basement of the hospital. He hadn't known that Alamo County Hospital had a morgue, although he should have. But no one thought about things like that unless circumstances forced them to. Years ago, every time they'd gotten one of those phone calls about unidentified remains had been a special sort of hell. Claire would be overwrought, contemplating all the horrible ways their daughter, if it turned out to be Kelsey, could have died. He had never been able to stop his wife from using the intervening time to look up everything she could about the discovered body, which only fueled her endless cycle of emotional frenzy that had exhausted them both. No one who hadn't lost a child in the same manner would ever understand. Loss was a fanged beast that could devour a person whole. He'd had to step back from the constant agony, or it would have consumed him, as it had consumed his wife. But this time was different. They'd finally reached the end of the interminable road they'd been traveling. There was no way to brace himself from the despair that awaited them. It was only at this moment that David realized he'd somehow managed to convince himself that this day would never come. Mark pulled into the hospital parking lot, the same hospital where David had welcomed the birth of both of his daughters. First, Kelsey, red-faced and squalling, fists pumping as she screamed her displeasure to the world. And then Janie, quieter even then, watching the world with wary eyes and a guarded expression. A sob clogged his throat. He didn't want to go in there. Would have given anything to avoid the next hour of his life. What was the purpose when he already knew the outcome? They sat there for a moment, no one talking. Then Mark spoke. "It's your choice, but this is unnecessary. Later today, the body is due to be transported to Madison County Hospital in London, where a pathologist will perform the forensic examination followed by the autopsy. The tests..." "If it were your child, would you wait?" Claire's voice rang out, clear as a bell. The agent didn't answer. Turning off the car, he got out and waited for them to join him before leading them inside the building. Time slowed. The long trek to the elevators. The slow descent. Then their arrival in the basement. Cold concrete floor. Musty smells. Walls that hadn't been painted in decades. Mark had used his phone to send a text before entering the building, and there was a man standing outside in the hallway with a lab coat on, waiting for them. Without conscious thought, David slipped an arm around Claire's shoulders as the stranger ushered them into a sterile room with metal gurneys and foreign equipment that he didn't want to examine too closely. The hospital employee said nothing, as he led them to a line of metal doors in the wall. Smaller ones across the top, a few larger ones on the bottom. He unlocked a bigger door and pulled out what looked like a long metal drawer, holding a dark bag with a small ziplock next to it. Slowly he lowered the zipper of the larger bag, parted it.
"That's not Kelsey! It can't be!"
Claire sounded more desperate than certain. David forced himself to look at the remains for a moment before hissing in a breath and averting his eyes. For the first time, he indulged in a brief fantasy that his wife was right. There was nothing recognizable about the body. Maybe this was a mistake. Maybe the matching dental records were wrong.
"This was found with the body."
The man held up the baggie for them to see. David stared at the necklace inside the clear bag, the agony of recognition clawing bloody furrows across his mind. A crystal blue butterfly on a silver chain, just like the ones his wife had bought the girls for Christmas a lifetime ago. Just like the one Kelsey had been wearing when she'd disappeared. Claire's scream echoed in the room, streaked down David's spine, scraping nerve endings that were already raw. He stared at what was left of his daughter. His arms shot out to catch his wife, just as she crumpled. Then he turned them both away from the sight that would inevitably haunt his dreams.
"That's Kelsey."
His voice was thick with unshed tears. Kelsey, the way no parent should ever have to see their daughter. Claire's wails reverberated in the area, a constant stream of grief that hinted at an oncoming breakdown. He guided her from the room, saying over his shoulder,
"My wife is going to require a doctor."
David slowly made his way down the stairs, placing one foot in front of the other, like an automaton. Claire was asleep, thanks to the sedative the doctor had given her at the hospital. There'd be follow-up visits required, the man had gravely informed David. Perhaps a complete workup with a mental health professional, given her past history and the current trauma. He had nodded, although in truth, he'd barely listened to the man. His mind had been filled with memories of his daughter. A tiny, twisting body that had defied his efforts to dress her in the little rompers and dresses Claire had bought. An attractive toddler with an outgoing personality and a penchant for getting her own way. A budding beauty in her teenage years, alternating between youthful exuberance and the drama of puberty. A stranger with contempt in her gaze, hurling insults and accusations, making demands he never should have met. He wondered if other parents who had lost a child had this hole inside them where all their regrets lived. Every cross word uttered, every moment they'd let their child's chatter slide over them, by them, without really listening. All the wrong decisions made, each failure that could never be undone. Sometimes at night they rushed forth to swamp him, strangling him with remorse. His step faltered on the final tread when he noticed Mark seated in the living room. He'd almost forgotten the man had followed him into the house, helped him get Claire's near-comatose body upstairs. The agent looked up at his approach, put away the cell he'd been texting on as he rose.
"How's your wife?"
David flushed. It hadn't been just Claire that had kept him upstairs, but the single frantic phone call he'd made to his attorney.
"She'll sleep for several hours. That's probably best."
Best. As if that were a word that could be applied to either of them right now.
"Thanks for helping with her. I have to tell Janie."
A boulder lodged in his throat at the thought. He took a breath and tried again.
"She's at work until 7. I don't know if I should call and have her come home sooner. But what's the point of that, right? Why ruin her world before I have to?"
A sudden thought occurred.
"Unless... there's no way this news could get out, is there? I don't want to chance her hearing about it because someone leaked the information."
Mark regarded him somberly.
"I'm not claiming a leak couldn't happen. I don't think it will. But if I were you, I'd have your daughter come home as soon as possible. Just in case."
Nodding jerkily, David realized the horror of the day wasn't over. Not nearly.
"I'll do that. I want to offer my sympathy again, Mr. Willard. Is there anything else I can do for you?"
David grimaced.
"Not unless you can undo the last 48 hours.
I wish I could. I'll talk to you soon, when I have updates." He nodded wearily. They always promised that. But the updates wouldn't change anything. They wouldn't bring Kelsey back.
"God, David, I'm sorry. I replayed our conversation in my head all the way over here."
Brant Strickland unbuttoned his coat, sat down on the leather recliner in the family room.
"What a shitty, shitty day. I'd always hoped, like you and Claire did, that Kelsey would be found safely. What can I do? How can I help?"
Funny, Mark had made a similar offer minutes ago, but the attorney was in a much better position to assist him than the law was.
"You can advise me on how to proceed from here."
David pulled a canister of scotch from a cabinet in the entertainment center and took out two glasses, poured a healthy splash into both of them. Crossing to where the other man sat, he handed him one.
"I can get ice."
"This is fine." Brant took the glass, watching him carefully. David took a gulp, his eyes watering, then another.
"Janie's on her way home, so I have to make this quick. I told you that the body..."
His eyes filled, and he choked on the word.
"Kelsey's body was found in the basement of that empty lake house."
"On Fuller Road, yes. I can't wrap my head around it, to have her so near all this time." Brant shook his head and raised the glass to his lips.
"They'll tear the place apart. Do their forensic testing, dust for fingerprints.
He saw the arrested look on the other man's face, met his gaze squarely.
My prints are going to be there, Brant. I mean, I assume so. I don't know how long they last, but...
He finished the scotch, wished the liquor could erase the heart-crushing trauma of the day.
I was there a few times about 7 years ago.
It's been empty for 10.
The other man frowned.
No way to get inside.
The woman I was meeting had access. She was the realtor.
She...
Brant mulled that over for a moment.
Well, a realtor sells properties. Maybe you were interested in buying it. Doesn't hurt to take a look at things, does it? Hell, I've driven by that place 1,000 times thinking what a waste it is, sitting empty like that.
David stared into his empty glass.
My prints will be only in the bedroom, and I know they have them on file. The police took elimination prints when Kelsey was taken. It's only a matter of time until they start asking questions.
Questions you don't have to answer.
Brand was firmly in attorney mode now. I'm not saying you can't talk to them. There will be details flowing in as the forensic tests are completed. But if they broach this subject, you call me.
I don't want to become their focus.
He heard a sound on the street. Was Janie home? He walked across the room, hooked a finger in the curtain to pull it back so he could look out. No. Relief filled him. He had a few more minutes anyway. Turning back to the other man, he continued.
They've got a new suspect in the case. I'd just be a distraction.
Is this realtor still around, in case they start asking questions?
No.
And he and Tiffany had been careful. That had been part of the thrill at first, the clandestine meetings, the isolated surroundings.
So she showed you the property. Just because they don't find prints in other rooms doesn't mean you aren't in them. Maybe you didn't touch anything anywhere else. Prints get smudged. We could argue they could be all over. They just failed to find other clear matches. Hell, we don't know that they'll get a clear set in the bedroom.
David had a mental picture of his body pressing against Tiffany's, hands on the wall on either side of her head, while he pounded himself into her, leaning over the fireplace to build a fire with wood she'd bought downtown, shutting the door with one palm as he gazed at her naked body stretched out on the air mattress she'd carried in the trunk of her car. He didn't respond to Brant's words. There'd be a match. It was more than guilty conscience that made him certain of that.
But the more I think about it, the more I think you'd be better off not to play the lawyer card if they ask about the house. Just tell them what you told me, that you looked at it a couple of times, decided not to make an offer. That should put an end to things.
A measure of relief worked through him.
Thanks.
No problem.
Brant drained his glass and set it on the end table next to the chair.
Does Janie know?
David shook his head.
I have to figure out how to tell her.
His mouth clamped shut. Where the hell would he find the words?
I could stay if you want.
David shook his head.
I need to do this myself. Somehow I have to find the words to explain to my daughter that her sister is dead.
Special Agent Mark Foster, November 15th, 5:58 p.m.
I know my rights.
Herb Newman was decidedly less talkative this time around. He glared at Mark balefully.
You gotta charge me, or let me go.
You've been charged, Mr. Newman. How had the man missed that? For trespassing and 2 counts of possession of an illegal substance. You'll be arraigned tomorrow, which makes it imperative that you be more forthcoming this time around, because a large quantity of drugs was found in the room next to the one you used in the lake house, and under the circumstances, you're the first we're looking at as the owner. There were far more serious charges pending, but that was a conversation for later.
No way!
Newman shook his head violently.
You can't pin that on me! I'm not the only one with a key to the place! There's nothing to tie me to the stash, I know that much.
You don't seem surprised to hear about it, though. Mark set the file he carried on the table while he unzipped his coat. Unlike most interview rooms he'd been in, this one wasn't freezing. He was already starting to perspire, and he'd just gotten there. Maybe you know who it belongs to. Could be one of the other people who has a key. The man's mouth twisted.
The cops had one.
Given to them by the realtor so they could check on the place from time to time. Seems that it's a magnet for parties, and apparently illegal activities.
I don't know who else has keys.
Where did you get yours? The big man studied his fingernails.
Don't recall.
You seem to have a problem with your memory. Damn, it was hot in here. Mark shrugged out of his coat. Newman seemed comfortable enough, but he was dressed in a short-sleeved orange jumpsuit provided by the county, one that was a size too small. The fabric strained over the man's girth. You forgot to tell us that some of the pictures you took of the teenage girls violated child pornography laws.
Bullshit! Those pictures are artistic, and they were taken at the girls' request.
It was easy to lose faith in the intelligence of humanity when faced with people this dumb. Yeah? In the recording I heard, you were the one suggesting a girl take off her clothes. We've got your computer, Newman. We've seen the pictures. Thousands of digital files uploaded over the years. The cyber team would be able to match the most recent uploads to the SD card in the camera. Their findings have been enough to receive a warrant broadened in scope to include his car and the school, in case he'd hidden more evidence there. Mark opened the file to take out a scrap of paper with a URL printed on it, held it up for the man to read. Recognize this web address? I see that you do. Mark lowered his hand. It had been included in Janie Willard's statement the night she'd been arrested for trespassing.
No.
Whether from the heat in the room or Mark's visual aid, the man was starting to sweat.
I don't even know what that is.
I figured you'd say that. Taking his time, Mark put the paper back inside the file folder. So, before we shipped your computer off to the lab, the deputies did a little investigating. And imagine their surprise when they went to that URL and found a whole site with pictures just like yours, all available for download at a price.
I don't know what you're talking about.
A bead of sweat rolled down Newman's face and was lost in his beard.
You can't prove that because it didn't happen.
Oh, but we can. Mark repositioned his chair so he could stretch his legs out under the table. See, those guys at the lab are computer geniuses. They can track every site you ever visited, even if you tried to hide your tracks. Uploads, downloads, everything's an open book to them. It's just a matter of time before they provide me with a detailed, day-by-day account of every activity you've taken on that laptop.
But I'm not the only one who used it,
the man said triumphantly.
I've loaned it out a few times to the churches. I do janitorial work for 3 of them in the area. Sometimes the pastors need an extra laptop if one in the office goes to the shop or if they have extra help there working on a project.
And did you give the ministers the password to your picture files? Mark asked. Because it'll be easy enough to check the dates your computer was loaned out and match those against the dates of the picture uploads from your laptop. Who were the pastors who had access to it?
Pastor Jennings at Hope Springs, here in town. Reverend Mickelson at Trinity Baptist in West Bend. I don't know.
The man rubbed his forehead as if the act of recall pained him.
Maybe Pastor Wells and Blackston?
Mickelson. A thrum of excitement started in Mark's veins. He considered Newman, weighing how much to hit him with all at once. They were pressed for time. Once the janitor started thinking about what they had on him, he was going to start screaming for a lawyer. It was a wonder he hadn't already. Here's the thing, Mark decided to lay it all out. We have you with a key to a property you don't own. Your voice on a recording offering illegal drugs to a teenage girl. You've admitted to taking nude or partially nude pictures of underage girls for a number of years. There's your proximity to a large stash of drugs, and as far as we know, you're the only outsider with access to the property. But the most damning thing is the body we found in the basement. The body of Kelsey Willard, a girl that, by your own admission, you photographed. A girl whose pictures were uploaded to that site. The sheriff had shown him the photos his deputies had found while combing the site, minutes before he'd started the interview. It was one more damning piece of evidence against this man. A girl who went missing shortly after you met with her. The man's jaw dropped.
No fucking way. Are you kidding me?
His eyes widened.
No, you aren't pinning that on me. I've used that place for like 6 months. That girl's been gone for, I don't know exactly, but a lot of years.
Where were you taking pictures before?
303 Ferguson, on the south edge of town. I had the second floor of a duplex. The place on Fuller Road just fell into my lap, and I figured, hey, bigger space, more privacy.
Someone else's property? Newman acted as if he hadn't heard Mark's words.
Who the hell knows how many others have keys? But I'm not gonna take a fall for the drugs or a dead body. Josh Farron gave me a key in exchange for some pictures I took for free. He probably swiped it from his mother. She's the realtor for the place. Thank you, Mrs. Farron. Have a good night.
Sloane disconnected the call and set her phone on the edge of the bed beside her, sending Mark a smug look. Carla Farron is positively irate about people trespassing at one of the properties in the realty's portfolio. She's going to insist on charges being filed. She was quite indignant when I asked about access to the keys for the lake house. According to her, they're kept in a locked case at the realty office, although they arrange for a regular cleaning service for the owners. An outside service hasn't been used in several months because, get this, her son is being paid to take care of it. Which backs up Newman's story about how he acquired possession of the key. Unfortunately, he's also telling the truth about the place he rented up to a few months ago. Sheriff Richards had put in a call to Police Chief Miller. Apparently, the address of the property had been a bane for city law enforcement for some time, so he's well acquainted with the landlord. I put in a call, and the man verified the approximate dates that Newman had rented from him. Mark rubbed the back of his neck tiredly. It had been a trying day, but in the grand scheme of things, it didn't come close to the day experienced by the Willard family. His sympathy for their tragedy could blind him if he let it, could fog objectivity and alter investigative decisions. But he'd have to be made of stone not to feel compassion for parents given the worst sort of closure in the disappearance of their child. If he ever got used to delivering that sort of news to families about their loved ones, it was time to switch jobs.
And you haven't heard a word I said.
His attention jerked back to Sloane. What?
Carla Farron? I asked how long she'd been showing the property. She said she'd only been with the company since she moved to town 2 years ago, but it took very little coaxing to get her to rattle off the other three realtors before her who had tried and failed to sell the place.
Good. We'll need that information when the pathologist narrows down how long Willard has been dead. Speculating about the length of time her body had been at the lake house would be dicier. Sloane approached the table and picked up a pen to write the names Farron had given her on a small pad of paper.
I think we need to consider what Rossi told us about the break-in at the lake house 3 years ago.
A window had been broken out in back near the kitchen, Mark recalled. The deputies had blamed vandals, but had the killer gained access that way? And why the change in dump sites? According to Sims, the 10-mile radius in Wayne National Forest, where the other victims had been found, had been isolated, difficult to reach. So breaking and entering to hide a body in a crawl space would be much easier in comparison. It also might signal that Willard's was a copycat killing and not the work of the TMK at all. Sloane rubbed her eyes. For the first time, Mark noticed shadows beneath them. He quickly looked away. It didn't pay to observe anything about the woman that didn't pertain to the job. But he recalled in that moment that he'd worked 2 cases with her, and he knew little about her personal life. Under the circumstances, it wouldn't be wise to change that now. He turned his attention to his email to answer the work-related messages he'd received that day. There would be investigative reports to pore through, his own to write, and the priorities for tomorrow to discuss with Sloane. Priorities that would be shifted accordingly as the forensic results started filtering in from the lab. For a moment, he was distracted by the array of pictures Sloane had run off from the TMK case file. The top row had photos of the 4 victims Sims had guessed were the work of the killer, although their bodies hadn't been found. Whitney DeVries's photo had been added, a constant visual reminder of what was at stake. In the next row were the verified victims. Sloane had switched Kelsey Willard to that line of pictures, for the time being, More evidence would be needed to ensure that she belonged there. She began typing and Mark started to scroll through his email. Stopped when his phone rang. He pulled it out and glanced at the screen. Didn't recognize the number. Mark Foster.
Mark, this is Greg Larson.
He glanced at Sloan. Larson, he mouthed. Then he pushed away from the table to stand. Greg, sorry to bother you on the weekend.
Not at all,
the other man replied.
Your reports have been forwarded to me by your SAC.
Mark's brows rose. That was news to him.
I understand that you have tentative ID on Kelsey Willard's body.
Positive, as of today. The parents ID'd it. There was a short pause, then a long whistle.
Tough day all around, then. How can I help?
You know where this victim was found. Mark dove right in with his questions. A total deviation from the other body dumps. Does it mean we're looking at a copycat killing, or a killer who has changed his M.O.?
Ask an easy question, why don't you?
The man joked.
The truth is, and you're not going to like this answer, it's hard to tell. We'll have a better idea when the tests are run on the body and we compare victim photos. Luther Sims, the agent who worked the profiling before me, did attribute one victim to a copycat, so it's possible. But it'll take time to make that judgment.
Mark had spent a couple of hours going over the digital photos of past victims. He hadn't found a glaring discrepancy between them and Willard's body, but there'd be tests on the fabric they wore, measurements on the exact angles of the limbs, comparison on the wire used on the fingers. With luck, they'd even be able to tell if the wire came from the same lot as that used on the others. What would cause an offender to change part of his routine like that? Mark paced the room as he spoke.
A change in his circumstances?
He could hear the shrug in the other man's voice.
Maybe he was physically unable to make the dump in Wayne Forest. Pretty arduous terrain from the looks of the photos. Or perhaps this marks the beginning of a new trend of his, leaving victims close by their homes. Sort of a last twist of the knife for the parents.
Mark hadn't thought about that. What would it do to the Willards, he wondered, knowing that their daughter had been so near? Do you think it means he's in the vicinity?
With this dump, he switched from a rugged site to a basement, from outside elements to inside, from hard to find to... I saw the photos. It didn't look like great pains were taken to hide the body.
If it hadn't been for the drug dog, it wouldn't have been noticed, but I'm surprised no one observed the smell. Even that hadn't been overwhelming, however, until the bag had been opened. The place is empty, but there are showings for the property, a cleaning service, realtors, not to mention the occasional trespasser.
If I had to guess, and like too much of my job, this is conjecture. If this body does turn out to be the work of the TMK, for whatever reason, I'd predict he wanted her found. And there could be all sorts of explanations for that. To increase the family's suffering might be one. Another could be affection for this victim.
Luther Sims seemed to think that all the victims had a parent who was deficient in some way.
Yes, I've read his notes. Certainly he worked more closely with the cases than I have, but from the reports I don't really get that picture. But like I say, he met some of those people and I didn't.
They spoke for several more minutes before Mark disconnected the call, returned to his laptop. Larson thinks the killer may have meant for the body to be discovered. He considered what else the man had suggested. That the reason might be affection for the victim. Disgust twisted through him. Mark had what it took to follow the evidence, track down offenders, but ascribing the sickest serial offender in the state's history with any softer human emotions, that was probably beyond him.
It also might mean someone is screwing with us and trying to make it look like Willard was a victim of the TMK. Someone in the vicinity who knew about the empty house and saw a perfect opportunity to get rid of a body.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's going to be a few days until they complete the comparisons with the other verified victims. He returned to his email. He did say he's tentatively attributed a couple more victims from years ago to the killer. He's sending me photos. He waited impatiently for the email to arrive, opened it and clicked on the pictures attached and printed them. Sloan got up and fetched them from the printer tray. Without a word, she picked up the tape and hung them in the top row with the other unverified victims. Mark zeroed in on the first one, an odd sense of recognition flickering through him. Does that first picture look familiar to you? Only because they all have a similar appearance. That was true enough. All the pictured girls were attractive, with long dark hair and slender figures. Taken with the entirety of the collection, the sense of familiarity faded. He leaned closer to read the identifying information on the two girls in Larson's pictures. Betsy Graves and Dina Horton. He frowned as he reread the date on the first one. I don't know, he said doubtfully. 30 years ago? That's 8 years earlier than Sims thought the TMK had been active.
I don't pay much attention to the ones where no bodies were found. Sloan returned to typing a report. That's a good way to head down the wrong path. Start chasing after leads that have no evidence to support them.
Mark grinned. You know, you almost sounded like Craw there for a minute.
Be sure and let me know if I start looking like him, she retorted, then stopped when his cell buzzed again. You're Joe Hollywood tonight.
It's the sheriff's office, he said tersely before answering it.
Foster, it's Rossi. We've been running the fingerprints we collected from the lake house and matching them against ones we have in city and county files. Pretty sure we've zeroed in on the owner of that stash of illegals we found. Josh Farron, local punk who Newman named as giving him a key.
The realtor's son.
That's the one.
The sergeant sounded as exhausted as Mark was feeling.
His prints are all over those bags of illegals. But here's the thing, and this one's a doozy. In the bedroom, same place we found the drugs, we discovered latents that matched another set in our system. They belonged to David Willard.
Whitney DeVries, November 16th, 5:58 p.m.
It doesn't look as though you've eaten much today.
The words had something inside Whitney going still. How would he be able to see the small pile of food he'd set on the stage this morning? It was well outside the glow provided by the computer screen and projector. And now that she thought about it, how did he see in the morning when he brought the food? She'd been awake the one time. He'd arrived without any light of any kind. I haven't been hungry. She hadn't, because excitement and fear were gnawing a hole in her belly. Last night she'd finally loosened the last screw. Her success had filled her with triumph and a newfound fear. Now came the most difficult part. Each night when she quit working, she twisted the screws in loosely, so they'd be close to the bracket, but easy to unscrew when the time came. That time was tonight. Nerves clutched and jumped inside her. Another reason she hadn't been able to eat much since she'd started loosening the bar. Last night, before she finally went to sleep for a few hours, she'd fetched the leftovers and stowed them next to the shower. She had no idea where this place was, what she'd face when she got loose, or how long it would take to find help. If she could, she'd take some of the food with her.
You must eat to keep up your strength, Whitney.
Here came the lecture.
You have a duty to maintain your own health so you aren't a burden to others. If you grow weak, your progress will suffer. And if that happens, you will be punished. My mother always said that sickness was weakness manifesting itself in the body. You must not indulge yourself by allowing yourself to get sick.
His mother sounded like a real winner. Whitney nodded obediently, as if she wasn't contemplating the thought that he and his dear old mom must be a chip off the same sadistic block. Maybe it took a monster to make one.
I'm here to help you reach your full potential.
That syrupy sweetness was back in his voice. It always had her flesh prickling.
That's something so few people ever attain. With my help, you'll be one of a select number who do. But you must listen. Like most instructors, I can teach, but it's up to you to learn.
I'll try to eat an apple. Anything to shut him up.
Fetch a sandwich and an apple from the meals I brought you, and bring them to center stage.
She did as she was told. The food was always set almost out of reach of the chain, as if he knew to the inch how far it would stretch. Whitney shivered as the tips of her fingers touched the wrapped sandwich so she could pull it toward her. Of course he knew exactly how far it would stretch. Every tiny detail in her prison had been planned with one thing in mind: allow no escape. Retaking her spot in the pool of light provided by the computer screen and projector, she awaited further instruction. Fetch, she thought bitterly, like a trained dog. He treated her like an animal with everything he forced her to do, and the punishments for failing. Every year her class raised money for the local animal shelter. She'd gone once and never returned. It had been too